as a wonderful, wonderful start for the season. The artist Kambui Olashimi is with us tonight. I originally asked Kambui to be here as a representative for Four Freedoms, which is a platform for civic engagement, discourse, and direct action for artists in the United States, which I am most enamored with at this particularly charged moment in our time. But that said, while I'm happy to have Kambui here to shed some light on such an important endeavor, I am equally intrigued with the breadth of interest and means found in his personal work. As I have come to know it better and better as we've gone through this process of getting to know him and getting to know the work, I opened the announcement of tonight's presentation, which some of you may have seen, with, quote, Olashimi's work challenges established modes of thinking that commonly function as inevitabilities, which is from an interview for Yale Radio that took place this year, which this has become all the more clear to me as I have had the opportunity to visit with Kambui. He is most certainly comfortable with his own compassion for and far-reaching expectations of art, and I am very anxious to learn more about him and his approach to art in this Tuesday evening's presentation. Kambui was born and raised in a part of Brooklyn that is nicknamed Bed-Stuy, whose motto, according to Wikipedia, which I just find so interesting, is do or die. Did you know that? He's like, yes, I do.
Yeah.
And actually, after having dinner with Kambui last night, that makes perfect sense to me. He received an MFA from Columbia in 2013 and has participated in artist residencies across the globe, working within the realm of ideas rather than specific media. His work has been shown widely, including most recently showing Where Does the Time Go, which was screened at the Lincoln Center in New York in 2017, Sky Riders and Constellations this year at the Newark Museum in New Jersey, and Zulu Time, which opened in 2017 at Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, traveling to the University of Buffalo, where it will open like next, the 15th. So that's what he's been doing before he came here, was installing that, with its final destination, January 29th, being the Blanton Museum of Art in Austin. So that's travel distance. We can do a field trip. We can all go, and that's going to be January of 2019. So with that, let's learn more about Kambui and his work. Please join me in welcoming Kambui Olashimi.
How's everybody doing tonight? Nice. Thanks for coming out. Thank you, Terry, for inviting me. And thank you for the modern and all the staff here who made this possible. I really appreciate it. One of the things I'm going to talk about tonight is sight. The primary, I'm going to show you work from different periods of time and different projects. But the sort of through line here is just going to be sort of an approach to location and sight in the different iterations that it plays out in through the different works. When I first started making work, I did sculpture only for people. So if I knew you, I'd make you a sculpture. I'd make something for you and, you know, send it to you or leave it. But I never showed sculpture. I only did collage and photography. This was the very first sculpture that I made as like an artist, you know, and I ran into one of the commissioners for this. This was a public arts initiative in Queens, New York, where I now live as of a month ago. And I remember being like, you're going to give me $300 to make something? I was just like, wow. And so this piece is called Fishing for Wishes. And it's a mini Hall of Fame for wishes. And I was interested in how we have collectively this ritual of transforming kind of debunk currency that has so little value that we don't even, you know, attribute it to a true worth, and transforming that currency into something that is forever or transcendent beyond this world in a wish. And so I took 10 what I considered Hall of Fame wishes for my life and made these platforms in the bank. And while I was making it, people started throwing on pennies and making wishes, like while I was setting up. And this was a piece that was in the Norfolk Bank in Jamaica, Queens for about 2 years. And this is in 2003. This is also a piece from early on. This is 2005. And I've made around my way. So in Bed-Stuy, I would make these suitcase memorials when people passed. And I only made them for people on the block. You know, if you knew me, you could get one. And I would just, you know, when I came by to give my condolences, I usually would talk with people. And that was a part of, like, my non-art practice. And in 2005, I decided to make some of these for my siblings after my mother had passed in 98. And you can see, I'll go back, you can see that in a lot of this work, there's the sculpture itself is a site. It's like, this is a vanity you go to regularly. You need to water this cactus regularly. There's this funny story of me going into my, the curator of the show likes to like make fun of me. I used to show up every couple of days to sort of water my art. And security was always like, wait, you can't, what are you doing? For me, suitcases were a very important sort of metaphor and motif. Like, you have to decide, you have to figure out what it is that you're going to take on this journey, and it's always a whittling down of the most important things. And so, you know, in many different sectors of spirituality, there's a journey that happens, you know, and that journey, there's a whittling down. So I always thought that suitcases, also I traveled a lot growing up, like I moved around a lot. So this idea of this is the best of you. And so this is, before I go forward, this is called, the series that I made for my siblings were called A Proper Burial. And so where does the time go? Anybody been to Detroit? Detroit is, in some ways, is kind of like a ghost town. It's gone through a lot recently. And all of those ups and downs, or the mainly downs that they've gone through, it's like people can't understand how that could happen. It seems unfathomable. And being from Brooklyn, there's this idea that Brooklyn's on the opposite spectrum, that it's become, you know, so slick and so gentrified that, like, you know, we wouldn't understand. You know, my friends from Detroit are like, you wouldn't understand. And in the 70s, New York City was bankrupt. And they pleaded to the federal government for help, for a bailout, and the government was like, go figure that out on your own. And it was growing up as a child in the 80s that I could see the sort of blocks on blocks that were burnt down from the riots in the late 70s. I could see the slumlords that had burnt down their own houses for insurance money. You know, there's the classic, the Bronx is burning, quote, if anybody's a baseball fan, where there's so many fires in the Bronx that during this Yankees game, you know, the announcer, it's like, oh, well, it looks like the Bronx are burning. So that's the Brooklyn and the New York that I knew. And so seeing Detroit, it was almost, being in Detroit, it was almost like a sort of amnesia and flashback at the same time, where so many people were saying, I don't know how this is happening. I don't know how we have a water crisis here. And I was like, I do. It's a neglected city. It's a city that's 80% black. It's a city that industry is pulled out of. than like the federal government has let fall to ashes. So talking with a friend of mine who was there, I started to work on a film that was about the sort of the location of both Brooklyn, which is now with gentrification having a mass exodus because of it's being turned into this kind of neoliberal strong box for equity where people are buying luxury apartments and not living there. So you have these kind of ghost towns that are starting to happen in New York where you have these skyscrapers, but there's no schools because people don't live there. It's just a place to sort of hold, you know, multi-million dollar apartments, that equity. And then it's even spreading to Brooklyn. So you have that kind of displacement of people in Brooklyn and a displacement of people in Detroit. And so for me at the time, this is like 2015, 16, that it just seemed like a twinning. So I started going to those two places. And this is a piece called Where Does the Time Go? And it's about the sort of the vacancy of memory, the inability for us to describe place, the longing for a place that's not there. And it was scored live with Chris Pattershaw and Adam O'Farrell, two musicians, well-established jazz musicians. And so I made this piece at Lincoln Center, and it was a lot of fun to work with musicians. If you haven't yet done that, you should try it. And so I'm going to show you just a little bit of that. This is a five, the total film is about 20 minutes long. And so this is a 5 minute excerpt. Before I keep going, anybody have any questions? All right. There'll be time at the end. Think of them.
Thank you.
Let's stop there for a second. And one of the things that I noticed when I watched it today is this idea of just how much nature was in Detroit. And, you know, like wild cotton fields, and like this is just wild cotton, and those mulberry plants that were everywhere. You'll turn a corner and there'll be, you know, a whole block of that, which made it feel like it was a place so far away, whereas in, you know, in Brooklyn, you only really get that in cemeteries, so you only get that in Prospect Park, or, you know, you go all the way out to Queens, so it's kind of anti-city reclamation that happens. Another piece I'll talk a little bit about, so the work that I make tends to be not genre specific. You know, the work that I'm, what I'm thinking about is how there are certain sets of ideas or notions that are seen as inevitable, that have a kind of quiet consensus, and they go unchecked. And when you start to bring them out of the space of the implicit and bring them, you give them some gravity and some shape, and they sort of expose themselves, and we're left to re-examine. One of those such things I was looking at was just love. And this was a piece that was traveling. This is at the Brooklyn Museum in New York. And it went to Mass MoCA, and it was an environment where it was multi-channel video with surround sound. And there's a song, it's a soul classic called I'm Gonna Make You Love Me. I'm sure somebody's heard that. And they have, it's been re-recorded over 40 years, you know. You got French rappers, you got Michael McDonald, you got Stevie Wonder, Lil Stevie Wonder. So I took all those different versions and made a soundtrack that was about 2 hours long, and filmed all of these skies from around the world and created this kind of kaleidoscopic landscape. So the loop, the thing that sort of what I wanted to point out is that the visual loop and audio loop were staggered, so the combinations kept always rolling through different. So when you would show up on Thursday, you might see this guy and there might be silence, or there might be a cacophony of different layers over top one of another. And I wanted it to be long enough so that people could rest there. In this image, you see just one, but there was, you know, multiple squares for people to sit in. So it became a place of reflection. And growing up in BK, I would go to the Brooklyn Museum all the time. And it was just like babysitting. Like, I would just go there, and I had my favorite works, and I'd go visit my favorite works. And I'd, my big sister likes to make fun of me, as big sisters are prone to do. About one time when I went there, and I started crying because they had moved my sculptures, and I was standing where they were. I was just like crying my little, was like 6-7 year old heart out. And the security guard comes up to me, who I still works there, and I saw like as a man, and he said to me, "Yeah, you look familiar." And I didn't have the heart to tell him, "Yeah, I was that little kid that was crying here like 20 years ago." And he was like, "Yeah, come here, just come with me." And he took me into a different wing, and they had reinstalled these totem poles. So the museum for me is a really special. This museum is a really special place. So I wanted to make this piece operate in a similar way, where it's again, like I say, a site that you return to, and every time you sit down with it, it's not the same, as you're not the same. So this is just 2 minutes, and what I tend to do a lot of times with these video installations is show a little bit of what the installation was, as well as what the video feed was.
I'm gonna do all the things for you a girl wants a man to do. Oh, baby, I'll sacrifice for you. I'll even do wrong for you. Oh, baby, every minute, every hour, I'm gonna shower you with love and affection. Look out, it's coming in your direction. And I'm gonna make you love me. Oh, yes, I will. Yes, I will.
My love is strong, you see. I know you'll never get tired of me. My love is strong, you see, I know you'll never get tired of me.
My love is strong, you see, I know you'll never get tired of me.
My love is strong, you see, I know you'll never get tired of me.
My love is strong, you see, I know you'll never get tired of me.
My love is strong, you see. My love is strong, you see.
A girl to do. Oh, baby.
Oh, baby.
I'll sacrifice for you. I'd even do wrong, too. Oh, baby.
Thank you,
So one of the things that was cool about being in the room with it was that it was quadraphonic sound. So, you know, I broke the channels up into four tracks. And so you'd have like little Stevie Wonder on a loop being like, oh, baby, come on. Oh, baby, come on. Come on. And then you'll have like Diana Ross or Dionne Warwick in another corner. And there are times when it just like overlaps and steps. And so I think... This was a beginning of a kind of spatializing, like formally I'm interested in the spatialization of video right now, like how to sort of push it. And I'll talk about it at the end. Like, let's tear it apart. Let's like talk about the physicality of the medium. But in doing talks like this and just thinking and walking, I've been thinking this is like one of those seed when those, I call them turnkey pieces, those things that like unlock something. You make a piece and you're like, oh, I'm doing ABC. And then in a year or 2 years or 3 years later, you're like, oh, that planted the seed for this other thing. And so in your absence, definitely planted the seed for the stuff that you're going to see at the end. I'm not going to tell you because then you'll just leave. So, moving through different mediums, a couple years ago, the city of New York commissioned me to do a permanent installation in the subway, on one of the subway stations. So I wanted to take, start with, in your absence, this, you know, and make some glass pieces. So these are the tests for them. And then this is out in Queens. Somebody said they had somebody in LIC, and they had a daughter in LIC. This is right there in LIC, so next time you go visit, go to Depth Glass and check them out. It's called Where Does the Sky Begin? And the laminated glass, and this is them still being installed in, on the Avenue I station on the F train. It's my friend's daughter. And so that's going to be a permanent installation for the rest of my life, 50 to 100 years. It's like hurricane proof, shark proof, all that. And so this begins, so a lot of stuff kicks around in my brain for a while before it comes out in art. And so anybody recognize this off the top? Know what this is? What this is? So these are all dance marathons from the 20s and 30s. There's a movie called They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Yeah, I know about that. Coney Allen. Yeah. Young Jane Fonda. So there was this phenomena that sort of gets swept under the rug with these dance marathons with people. In the 20s and 30s, it was mainly one person would dance, multiple partners, and dance as long as they could to recognizable dances. And that would go 60 to 80 hours. Almost all the winners were women. And the press had a field day and was like, you know, they're going to die. They're women. They can't dance for that long. Then in the 30s, the really end of the 20s, there's a crash, the stock market crash. And then in the 30s, promoters sort of like realize they can make a ton of money if it's not recognizable dances and if it's just partners. You partner up and that's your team. And what's interesting to me, and they would go 5 or 6 months, 7 days a week, and people would come and watch them sleep, and people would come and, you know, come to hear stories about them. So it was a platform, and people would do things like, you know, all of a sudden I become Johnny, a runaway, and every day I come out and I play my bugle in case my brother is in the crowd. And so they would come do these solos, and people would throw money at them, and it became a platform, you know. It described all of these elimination rounds and things that you see in reality TV and roller derby and soap operas all come from dance marathons, you know, like fake marriages. People would have fake marriage, you know, to get have a fake wedding all while they're dancing, you know, and they would get real gifts and they would keep them. And so it wasn't about who won. It was about the story that you could create while you were still in the contest. So I was interested in it as a platform for both identity and fluidity of identity, but also ideas of capacity, endurance, persistence. Because it was a kind of grotesque thing in a precarious way where you were both, you know, people were coming to see you struggle because if, you know, they don't have it as bad as you. But then if you can keep going, then maybe they can keep going. So it was this kind of double-bladed sword. So 2011, after I saw the movie, I think I saw the movie in like 2008, and it kicked around in my brain for a couple of years, I started making these platforms that were sort of, you know, the way I was thinking about them was architecture, where, you know, a church is a church because of what happens in it. If those things stop happening, the church gets sanctified. It's no longer a church. And so the action imbues the object with its integrity. So I wanted to make these pieces that were the site for discussions and actions around persistence and all of those things that happen, persistence, endurance, all of those things that are happening in that phenomena. And if it's not happening, then they just go to get burnt. So this piece, Finding and Forgetting, the first time I showed it, was two dancers dancing through exhaustion to synchronized soundtracks. So the image that we're accustomed to seeing from that time is those two bodies intertwined. So I wanted to start with like an overhand right and just start off with something very, very different. And the tie then becomes the sonic tie. So you hear it and then you walk through the gallery and you hear it again, and it's kind of an echo. The following year, I danced on a whole platform together from sunrise to sunset. It was a little more than a 12-hour performance, and same rules as the dance marathons, which were an hour on, 10 minutes off, or 90 minutes on and 15 minutes off. And you do everything, you eat, you shave, whatever. What I found after, you know, two breaks that it actually takes you out of your head. And so I just danced all day and lost a bunch of weight and cramped up. I got my friend, one of my oldest friends, and I told him I wanted him to DJ. And he was like, you can hire another DJ for 5 o'clock in the morning. And I was like, I need someone there in case I hurt myself. So that if I think somebody that can override me, so if I think, you know, I'm good, someone's like, no, your leg is broke. Or someone's like, no, just walk it off. And I was like, I gotta trust you. And so this was the inspiration for trying to figure out, well, what does that architecture look like? It's almost invisible. It's flexible. It's kind of like a scaffolding. It almost seems like it's temporary. And so I was looking at the Cyclone, and it was built in 1927. And has anybody ever ridden that thing? Yeah, isn't it like a death trap? Were you terrified? It's like if you rode it in the 40s, you were terrified. If you rode it in the 50s, you thought it was going to break down. If you rode it in the 60s, 70s, 80s, no matter when you rode it, it always seemed like it was on death's doorstep. And it survived Hurricane Sandy. And so it, for me, became this patron saint of imminent disaster. It's just like, yeah, no, I'm about to die. Hold on. Tomorrow, come back tomorrow. I'll break up tomorrow. So then returning back to Detroit, I was invited to do this piece, and it's a big space, and what I wanted to do was get all of these objects from failed businesses and abandoned homes and use it to make my way through the space. So when the performance starts, the 5,000 square foot gallery is just empty, and performers bring out these objects one by one and create a way to traverse the space. And it's called The Conspiracy of Good People. And so growing up and it was, you know, live music again was there. And so she would play music while I'm dancing my way through the space as the path is being created. And growing up in Bed-Stuy, there was a lot of forces that were working against me. There were a lot of forces that were out to harm me directly. And my family was very conscious of letting me know, even as a child, and helping me to traverse it. But they also talked about this thing called the conspiracy of good people. And, you know, they would say, yeah, you know, there's a lot of systems that are trying to harm you. But when I got into the good school in the neighborhood that wasn't in my district, someone helped me, but helped our family, you know, a friend of the family was like, oh, you can use our address. Or, you know, when my mother had to work and I needed a place to come after school, somebody else would babysit me, and, you know, and so on and so on and so on and so on. And so this piece is called The Conspiracy of Good People because literally it is the way in which you make your way. So when I have any accomplishment, I always think about that. And even before I do something, I always think about, like, all the people who taught me how to do whatever it is. And I'm always thinking, man, hope I don't let them down. Or, man, they shouldn't have started. So this is a piece, again, in that same vein. So this is 7 years of work, you know, and I'm just showing you some of the work. I keep coming back to this dance marathon regularly. I did a commission for BAM. That was photographs. I've done, you know, sent all types of different things. This is a series. Those platforms get bigger and they go to like 35 feet. And when I first started, I was making these abstract drawings that were really like topographical. Where it's darker, it's higher, where it's lighter, it's lower. And it was a way in which I could describe what I was going to build to people who were helping me build it without sounding too crazy. And Tomas Vu, who was here, came to visit my studio and just bugged me. I was like, well, you need to show these. You need to come make some prints with us. And I was like, yeah. And a year went by, another year went by, 2 years. About 4 years later, I was like, you know what, Tomas, I'm going to make some prints. And so these are called endurance diagrams. And they're just the way, there's sort of a space of potentiality where that gesture and that movement turn into this sort of place of abstraction. And you'll see that in a lot of the work, a toggling between either figurative and abstract, or like legible and illegible, because it's where we live. I don't think of it as a real distinction. I just think of it as like a fluid, like as we move, you know, like scat, you know, or that little part in the song where somebody goes, and you're like, what is that? What is that? That's not on the lyrics. And so this platform actually went through into another gallery. So you had to climb it. And when you climb it and stand up, you actually see how the relationship with the endurance diagrams. And I filmed A Faint Notion, which I'm not going to show today, but is on Vimeo. You can check it out. I filmed it on this platform, and it was projected in the room. So you have this kind of, again, this twinning or this kind of slippage of sight. And then at Bemis, so I've been doing these, and each one is site-specific. This one is around 16, 12 by 5 feet. It's called The Luck We Draw. And I'm going to show you a video. The way it starts off with all of these platforms, I make these platforms, and then they're a site for performances. And people will come and do other things, and I just get to go first. I want to break the champagne. And so I usually do some action on it or film others doing an action on it, and that is presented in conjunction with the sculpture. This is a piece called Staying Afloat. And again, I just thought about, like, I thought a lot about Float Like a Butterfly, Sting Like a Bee, Ali Had Just Died. I thought a lot about single moms and the levitation that they do, and how it's, you know, it's often forgotten that it's nothing less than miraculous. Shout out to Paul Pfeiffer. Anybody? I don't even know how to loop that in, but you, if you've seen his like early work, the Risky Business, you know. These are some of the other pieces that have happened on. This is called Just Because We're Magic Doesn't Mean We're Not Real. And this was another one of the sculptures. This platform had a myriad of things from lectures, poetry readings. This on the left is a junior high school showcase of fashion. This like long-term project that they do where they visit all these artists and then they make all the clothes and then they work with local artists and they make this performance. And then on the right is Margaret Jenkins Dance Company. She's been around 20 years. And so they did a performance and each dancer picked one of the endurance diagrams to do a solo one. And this is the structure that they used. This is the full piece. And we talked, the collaboration in this case was really interesting. It was, I do a fair amount of research just because, you know, I just get into certain things. And so the work comes out of these scratching and sniffing. And in conversations with the dancers and with Margaret, one of the things that they really latched on to was this idea of desperation, which I thought was really interesting. Desperation in relationship to identity, too. So this is one of the, and so this is a Catherine Clark Gallery where you can see the photographs, which I mentioned before, that were all around here, around the sculpture, and then there was a video room with all the videos from each platform, and then another room with the endurance diagrams. So Four Freedoms, our first collaboration, I've known Eric Gottesman and Hank Willis Thomas for way too long. Me and Hank have collaborated on pieces more than a decade ago, and we've been friends. And so when they were thinking of starting this initiative, we were talking about the ways in which in both of our works we were interested in engaging in the public, and this idea of sight comes up again and again. And they were thinking maybe we'll start a super PAC. And so they started, and it transformed from an LLC to this like initiative. And they just finished fundraising, and they've launched the 50 State Initiative, which is a town hall exhibition and billboard in all 50 of the states. And so it's a way in which art can be used to sort of kick up these discussions in ways that are not linear or polarizing, and still be very critical. And so the first, before they even got to that point, they were using the sort of initiative or this pack as an incubator. And so this was at MoMA PS1, and they gave me a room. And so I showed all of these videos that were around this idea of, you know, all my dance marathon videos with the source material. So this video on the right is called In Plain Sight. And it's these two dancers dancing with a third person just following them with a flashlight and in a completely darkened room. And on the left, one of the inspiration for that was, does anybody know before I say it? I hate when I'm Marvin Gaye. Marvin Gaye at the 1981 All-Star Game. He sang the national anthem. And it was amazing. But he got death threats. And he got death threats because he turned it into a kind of a soul, like an instant soul classic. And it was this idea that he was somehow desecrating something that was fixed, that there was a notion of what the anthem was and it should not change, or his assertion of his own citizenship was sacrilege. And that's the music that I used for this piece. It was also in San Francisco that I made it at the time when Colin Kaepernick was first kneeling in this protest. And it seemed almost like, you know, like there's a long legacy of protest during the national anthem, and no one could think that it would become as big as it has become. And so this is the billboard. I wanted to touch on it just a couple right now pieces. This is the billboard for freedom. And it is going up. We'll find out where it's going up. But I just can't. I have had a number of nights where I just haven't been able to sleep right, just thinking about, you know, all these immigrant families that have been separated. And that idea that that's what we're doing now. Is that what we, like, is that what we're doing as a nation? And it's chilling. It's chilling, and it puts me on my own heels where I try and think of, well, what it is, what am I doing? Often whenever I have a problem with something, I'm, you know, whether it's the, you know, the mayor, the governor, I try and put myself in their shoes. So what would you do about the trash problem you have in the neighborhood, you know? And it's been as an artist, it's been really difficult because there's this thing that happens where you have an input that's so strong, it's like someone screaming in every language, every word they've ever come up with. And it's your job as an artist to take that and sort of hone it into a poem or a song or into something that's not only, that doesn't have to be legible, but has to be something that's transcendent. And that's really difficult. And so this is like a very first step at that. And it's also working in conjunction with the other 50 billboards that will be nationwide. I'm not sure where in Texas, but there will be one here. When's the launch? We launch early October, late September. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I already sent, I asked if this was okay to show today. We have a launch when I get back to New York, and then, yeah, town halls, billboards. Most recently, one of the things that I've been thinking about is this notion of Black Rhapsody, this idea that in American history in particular, that elation and joy within the Black body and within the Black community has often been, you know, suppressed. And from enslaved Africans not being allowed to laugh and being this thing where there's it's called a laughing barrel. They would laugh into the barrel to sort of hide that joy to, it just goes on and on and on. And so I've been thinking about that and thinking about this idea of how peace and joy as a African-American or just within this Black body, within the African diaspora, is always expected in this afterlife that somehow later it'll come around to you, you know? And I was interested in vernacular joy. You know, anybody see that Mastery show, Kerry James Marshall? It was fire. It was like somebody punched you in the chest from the inside. And I saw it. I was in Chicago, and I was there for some other stuff. And I was like, oh, let me go check this real quick. And I go in, and I go to the first room. It's all Black people. Second room, all Black people. Amazing paintings, big paintings, delicate paintings. Go to third room, fourth room, go to the next floor. I was like, something strange. Something real, real strange. Like, I just didn't feel right. I've been to a lot of museums. I grew up in museums. I was like, something just don't feel right. And I got to the second floor, and I was like, I have never seen this many Black people depicted in a museum that wasn't the Studio Museum in Harlem. I've never seen just Black joy, like Black people being happy, not slavery, not civil rights, not joy in the place of this impending like pillar of doom that's coming, just like barbecuing. just like braiding hair. And it was painting, amazing painting after amazing painting after amazing. And it transformed my practice and has shaken me in a good way. So I started thinking about this, and I started thinking about how refraction is a strategy historically. You know, you don't come at it, you can't be too good. You know, like, how you doing? I'm all right. You're all right. Because to be really good somehow either means that you're not paying attention to the world around you, or you lying. And so that's just one of many different ways in which I found that refraction worked. And so I was like, let's put it to the test. Let's get to it. So this is the first piece in a myriad of pieces that I'll be making, where I'll be making these videos that have that go through prisms, and I'm making prisms, custom prisms. I didn't show any of my glass work, but and building these environments. So this is the first one I made April. And we'll get to it.
Good morning. No, good morning.
Good morning.
So I want to start by reading something to you guys, something I've never read out loud before. And I was trying to figure out what I could possibly say. Good morning. No, good morning.
Good morning.
By reading something to you guys, something I've never read out loud before, and I was trying to figure out what I could possibly say.
Hello. 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 Hello.
Even in my dreams, this could not be true.
When you watch Moonlight, you don't assume a boy who grew up how and where we did would grow up and make a piece of art.
Even in my dreams, this could not be true.
That wins an Academy Award. I've said that a lot. And what I've had to admit is that
even in my dreams,
I place those limitations on myself.
Even in my dreams,
I denied myself. I denied it because I never saw it.
Even in my dreams, this could not be true. Even in my dreams, this could not be true. Even in my dreams, this could not be true.
Thank you to the Academy. I don't know what to say. That was really, I'm not sure, I'm still not sure this is real.
Terrell and I are Chiron. We are that boy. And when you watch Moonlight, you don't assume a boy who grew up how and where we did would grow up and make a piece of art that wins an Academy Award.
Before I
certainly don't think he would grow up to win Best Picture.
When you watch Moonlight, you don't
I've said that a lot.
Grew up how and,
and what I've had to admit is that I placed those limitations on myself.
Award. I've said that a lot.
I denied myself
what
that
I've
dream.
Had to admit is that I placed those limitations
not you,
on myself.
Not anyone else.
I denied
me.
That dream.
And so,
I denied it
to anyone watching this who sees themselves in us, let this be a symbol, a reflection that leads you to love yourself. Because doing so may be the difference between dreaming at all and somehow, through the Academy's grace, realizing dreams you never allowed yourself to have.
And what I've had to admit is that I placed those limitations on myself. I denied myself that dream. I denied it because I never saw it. With this movie in particular, I had to be very active. I couldn't be at Video Village. And so I turn, I look back at one point, and I see all these kids who normally are running through my shot. They're sitting at Video Village. They're literally sitting in our chairs. They're wearing our contacts.
There was a time when I thought this movie was impossible. And so everybody behind me on the stage said, no, that is not acceptable.
I've said that a lot, and what I've had to admit is that I placed those limitations on myself. I denied myself that dream. I never saw it. And when I look back at these kids sitting in my chair, wearing my Comtex, watching us make this film that's going to go on to win Best Picture, they see in me the dream I never allowed myself to have. It floored me. It floored me. And if I cried that night, it wasn't because we won Best Picture. I cried because I realized I denied myself that dream for so long. And I didn't even recognize it when, through the help of my friends, I was able to give that dream to someone else. So that's what I got to say, man.
It's a privilege for us to present the final award of the evening. The films we honor tonight inspired us, touched our emotions, gave us hope and joy, and may even have changed our thinking.
Well, I think that it could be said that our goal in politics is the same as our goal in art, and that's to get to the truth. So that's like in the movies that we honor tonight that not only entertain us and move us, they show us the increasing diversity in our community and a respect for diversity and freedom all over the world. So, Faye, let's get to the movies.
Okay.
Yeah.
So here are the nominees for Best Picture.
The Academy Award for Best Picture.
You're impossible. Come on.
Moonlight, Best Picture.
Wow, this is...
This is Moonlight, the Best Picture.
Yeah.
Very clearly, even in my dreams, this could not be true. But to hell with dreams. I'm done with it, because this is true. Oh, my goodness.
Thank you to the... I don't know what to say. That was really... I'm not sure. I'm still not sure this is real, but thank you to the Academy, and very humbling to be up here. And I think, I hope even more than that, that it's inspiring to people, little black boys and brown girls and other folks watching at home who feel marginalized and who take some inspiration from seeing this beautiful group of artists helmed by this amazing talent, my friend Barry Jenkins, standing up here on the stage accepting this top honor.
I've said that a lot, and what I've had to admit is that I placed those limitations on myself. I denied myself that dream. I never saw it. And when I look back at these kids sitting in my chair, wearing my Comtex, watching us make this film that's going to go on to win Best Picture, they see in me the dream I never allowed myself to have. It floored me. It floored me. And if I cried that night, it wasn't because we won Best Picture. I cried because I realized I denied myself that dream for so long. I didn't even recognize it when, through the help of my friends, I was able to give that dream to someone else. So that's what I got to say, man.
Much love.
Good night. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Any questions? Yeah. That audio that you heard was Barry Jenkins at South by Southwest, where a year later he talked about a lot of things, his whole journey with the movie and filmmaking, but also what that night would have been and what he had in his mind and what he wanted to say. And for those who may not have seen the Oscars 2 years ago, I'm very happy that this is the first memory you will have of it.
It's so interesting. Can we see it in this context? It chokes me up. Like, I'm surprised at my response. I saw it, you know, 2 years ago, and I was horrified and excited and all the things that I think people felt, and it just seemed like it was kind of this amazing, I don't know, like it just seemed like it summed up everything that was right and everything that was wrong, you know, that accident. And I don't know what it is about seeing it here. It's like I got to see it. I wish that wasn't the first time I'd seen it. I wish I was introduced to it that way. Because, and what my question that I was forming as I was watching it, which I can't pull together to ask, but it has something to do with the way you made that. Like, what you accomplished. Like, you basically just gave us what happened 2 years ago. If we don't know that the audio is from another time. I mean, but somehow by fracturing it the way you did, by showing it, it's like, and I mean, maybe talk about how this works in your work, because I know, which I failed to mention, that you came to art through poetry and through writing. So I'm watching all of this and thinking about how the collage is so much about how you make a poem. Mm-hmm. Like, I think I learned as much about how to make a poem by looking at your art tonight as I did learned about your work. Like, I'm starting to understand how that works. But it's like I received it. I, like, now know that incident through feeling first, as opposed through my head. I mean, I still know it. It's still a form of knowing. But
one of the things that... So the incident, Best Picture was called as La La Land, even though Best Picture was for that year Moonlight. And the card that they were given was Best Actress. And they decided, it was Emma Stone, it said Best Actress, Emma Stone, La La Land. And so at that juncture when they realized that they had the wrong card, they made the guess that it was La La Land. Or they saw La La Land and just thought they won 6 other Oscars, they're going to win Best Picture. Whatever the case may be, it was announced and the whole cast came up and then the auditors came up and made the correction. And so that moment was forever marred. And one of the things I was trying to do with the fracturing, it breaks up kind of into three parts, and there's an introduction, the sort of ending or meet, and then the sort of, yeah, I think of it as the ending is the middle, and then the end is just real time. But it's this thing that I'm learning more and more about it with Senko analysis, where how do you return to a moment of trauma and recontextualize it so it's outside of your body, so it no longer is damaging to your body or your psyche. It's not about changing the moment, but I think of it as a reconstituting of that moment. So bullies you, well, what would you have wanted to say? Who would you want to be there? And so in reconstituting that moment, you're able to have that memory inside your body or inside your mind and it not be detrimental. And so I see this work as a sort of reconstitution of time. That's like you, an artist, you could just do it. You know, I remember wanting that moment that was taken away from me. And I sat with it for a year. And, you know, a year in my brain, something comes out. Any other questions?
I think, if everybody's like me, it's like I can't pull it together to ask a question. That was so moving. That was so moving.
Thank you. There was a lot of different things. So you don't feel obligated.
I'll go back to something that you showed at the beginning, which was your suitcase pieces. Did all of them have something alive in them?
Yeah, I tried to make something that was either alive or something that was you could use. So, like the tea set. It's like, you go make tea. My mother was in Yoruba. She was a priestess, and we had an altar. And so we had an altar for our ancestors. And there was food there. And there were this idea of commemoration not being something that you just put over there, but that you visit and it's a process. And so, yeah, I always wanted something that you could do. Even like the mirror, you know, the fact that like it has a utility. And I think that ties into this idea of the return. Like, that's how sight gets constructed, you know. What were you going to say?
Well, so then when you fragment something that could have been a very, very traumatic or a very, very emotional moment, when you fragment it and you yet keep transmit the view of something personal, like the woman that was sitting there listening all by herself, while in the room, mm-hmm. she was having a personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
And you say that every time you go in, you have a different personal experience because it is in a different place and will be in a different place.
Well, the components are different. So
yeah.
When she was there, that sky might have had,
whatever,
you know, silence, or it could have just been the sax solo from the Michael McDonald version. You know, so it changes, and so your literal what you see actually changes as you go through it.
So then, by fragmenting everything and then repositioning it, does it allow us to either more objectively enjoy or more objectively view something?
I'm not sure. I think what my logic is that you get to understand it better because you see it from different sides in different times, and it's not, there's that idea of like, oh yeah, I got this. Yeah, I got that. And I think I've never really been interested in that because I'm always like, I kind of go back, and I'll go back again, and I'll go back again. And it's like, you get what you get in that moment, but that's not it. And so when I go to make stuff, I don't worry about trying to describe totality because I think that's a losing battle. You can talk about aspects, and though you might give enough aspects for people to have a rich experience or to enter that house, but how they use the house is going to change. They might just hang out in the kitchen. You know, the bathroom might be their hangout spot. But it's a house, and it has all these different rooms, and people will utilize it and as they need in that time.
Could you? Oh, I'm sorry.
I just wanted to hear more about the transition from poetry to different mediums now that Terry's let it out.
I don't know that it is the bedrock. Like, it's the way in which, between that and collage, I was saying to Terry the other night that, like, I grew up reading poetry and writing poetry. I grew up in the time of hip hop, which is a collage medium. I was making collage. It's like, this is my, like, and I see it in, you know, I see it in my city. And so I feel like it's a constant. And one of the things I like about poetry is that there's an expectation of leaps. And, you know, when you make that leap, anything could happen between point A and point B, but you give people enough points for them to have that experience, to have that house. And that's what I try and bring to the work. I'm excited by the gaps. I'm excited by, there's always something where I'm like, I don't know even what this is. Like, what, this don't make no sense. But I feel it, and I feel like it's in that logic. And I think idiosyncratic making is important. And that comes directly out of poetry.
And so the only piece that had words that I remember is Consensus of Silence. Is that intentional?
I don't want to use text. I'm doing this billboard, and I was like, I don't really... Just because I think text... like, I write, and then I make visual work, but I try to keep text out because it's tied to... Like, okay, you see text, you're like, I'm speaking this language, I'm in this place, and it grounds you in a way that I'm very careful about. And so I might use it. Like, I don't, I'm sure I've used it a couple times, but in general, I don't really mess with text.
So why that piece that way?
I think the billboard is a medium that is in line with that. Like, it's a sight. You're mobile. You're looking at a thing that's huge, but because of your distance, it looks tiny, and you can't. When they first started making billboards, they thought people were going to get in car accidents, and they did. And so there's a way in which you can't have too much draw. Like, it almost has to operate peripherally, like an echo. And if you want to do a slow burn and on something like that, I kept thinking, well, how can you do it? Make the text really light so it sits back, and the image comes forward, but don't give them the image. So it was like this playing, and I felt like the image, the text gave enough room that I didn't feel boxed in. I haven't seen it yet. I haven't printed it. So I'll see if I'm like, oh, yeah, you put that in the trash. No. Or if I like it, you know. But that was the logic.
Thank you. Can I expand on that a little bit? So you don't have text, but you do have audio. And, of course, the audio is language.
Mm-hmm.
And you're hearing it. And so it grounds it in a way by putting it in a place in a certain language. And,
mm-hmm.
Does the text on the billboard operate like audio? Because as you're seeing that in your periphery, then the sound you get is the voice in your head saying it?
That's a good question. I feel like it doesn't, because usually the audio is like the spoken language in a lot of my videos are getting cut.
Yeah.
So they either cut with music or they're cut with an image that is pushing against it. You know, there's a piece, you know, so text is perfect. You ever read a book and all the characters are exactly how you imagine them? Because every book you do that. You're like, oh, yeah. And then you see the movie. I'm like, what is it? You know, who did they hire for this? Why did that happen? And so there's a perfection even in the sound of words in your mind. And I think that there's something that that is really different than an audio. Also, just the time, like, I can hear, like, snap over and over in my mind if I want. I can snap, and I don't need the sound, whereas when I say the word, it can only last that long.
Okay.
You know what I mean? It's like, it's, yeah, there's just other things that sort of at play with it.
Thank you.
Outside of like the literal use of endurance, can mm-hmm. you speak to the idea of endurance in your work?
I think endurance as a concept, I don't know, I think a literal thing like how one endures, how we get by, how we continue. And I think that that's an undercurrent in a lot of the stuff that I make. And I think that the way sight is performed is in this thing of duration. So duration is the sort of language I would use to sort of talk about endurance in a non-literal way. So how long is in the, you know, in your absence? Is it the piece is 4 hours, the video is 4 hours, the audio is 2 hours, and they're like both in change. You know, how long do you sit there? How much do you see? Do you see different segments? So this idea of it being something that's durational and that duration changing and being flexible based on your experience is something that's important to me. The same thing with the sculptures, where it's a site where you might come and you might see a performance, and that's what is imbued in that object for you, but it will change if you see something else or if you see three different things or if you come and dance with me. You know, all of those things sort of expand. They expand the time of the viewing for me. And I'm interested in echoes a lot. Like, how do you get in someone's mind and then go home with them rather than just like, got it. So I think that that's an idea that sort of plays out with duration for me. Okay, I think that we... thank you guys for coming out and staying. Come to the Blanton if you can on the 26th of January, and it'll be at the Blanton. Come through and just like, we're all wear the same thing. Take care.